And I'll read the our invitation to you. We of Overeaters Anonymous have made a discovery. At the very first meeting we attended, we learned we were in the clutches of a dangerous illness, and that willpower, emotional health, and self-confidence, which some of us had once possessed, were no defense against it. We have found that the reasons for the illness are unimportant. What deserves the attention of the still suffering compulsive overeater is this. There is a proven workable method by which we can arrest our illness. The OA recovery program is patterned after that of Alcoholics Anonymous. We use AA's 12 steps and 12 traditions, changing only the words alcohol and alcoholic to food and compulsive overeater. As our personal stories attest, the 12-step program of recovery works as well for compulsive overeaters as it does for alcoholics. Can we guarantee you this recovery? The answer is simple. If you will honestly face the truth about yourself and the illness, and if you keep coming back to meetings to talk and listen to other recovering compulsive overeaters, if you will read our literature and that of Alcoholics Anonymous with an open mind, and most important, if you're willing to rely on a power greater than yourself for direction in your life and to take the 12 steps to the best of your ability, we believe you can indeed join the ranks of those who recover. To remedy the emotional, physical, and spiritual illness of compulsive overeating, we offer several suggestions, but keep in mind that the basis of the program is spiritual, as evidenced by the 12 steps. We are not a diet and calories club. We do not endorse any particular plan of eating. We practice abstinence by staying away from eating between meals and all individual binge foods. Once we become abstinent, the preoccupation with food diminishes and in many cases leaves us entirely. All right, and I have asked Jim to read the 12 steps.
Good evening, my name is Jim. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Jim.
And here are the 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to care of God against the devil. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and no human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so, whether to them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive readers and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thanks, Jim. And Lisa will read the traditions.
I'm Lisa, compulsive overeater.
Lisa.
12 traditions. Number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity. Two, for our group purpose there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for OA membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or OA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. Six, an OA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the OA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every OA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Overeaters Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. OA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Overeaters Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the OA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, television, and other public media communications. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all these traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Lisa. All right. We're going to have a little bit of an introduction here. It's going to be a little bit different than we have at our regular meetings, so get ready. I told you that I was going to tell some fortunes tonight, and I am, because that's my character. And what I want you to do, if you're in character, introduce yourself as your character and tell us about your character, okay? If you're not in character, just introduce yourself and tell us about yourself, okay? All right, my name is Madam Wanda, and I'm a recovering compulsive overeater and a fortune teller. And I'm going to tell you some things about what will happen in the future, okay? That's what fortune tellers do, huh? Okay, if you follow the instructions in this book and in other books that we have here tonight, 12 Steps of OA, here's what you get, telling your future. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises?
We think not.
They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Work.
And it goes on to say this about alcohol, but we're going to relate it to food. We have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. Y'all like my fortune? Sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we will recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given to us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. We are not cocky, nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. So, you think I can take my show on the road with my fortune? Because aren't those wonderful promises in our future? And they really are. And you're going to hear about some of these coming through tonight. So, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, and I'm going to go start over here with Jennifer, and stand up and tell us who you are, a little bit about you.
Hi, my name is Jennifer, and I'm a compulsive blood drinker in recovery, compulsive overeater. I've been in the program for about 4 years, and I have 7 months of abstinence.
Hey. Thank you, Jennifer.
My name is Suzette, and I'm an overeater, sugar addict, carb addict, and I'm glad to be here. I actually am in another program that I have 6 years sobriety tomorrow, so I'm working on this. I'm working on this very hard.
It's hard.
Thank you, Suzette.
I'm Barbara. I'm a sugar addict, recovering compulsive overeater, and the proud mother of sons. One of whom is known as Papa Bear. And I expect this started out his, but I think his little brother wore it too. And for me, it just means my boy. And that's why it's so special to me.
Thank you.
Vicki, and I used to be a fraidy cat, and I used to be, I feel like a faux pas, and like I used, like I needed to be beat with a cat of nine tails, but now I'm just categorically grateful for recovery.
Thank you, Vicki. Claire, you want to just sit and tell us, or you want to stand up? It's up to you.
I'll just sit. Okay. It might fall down. I'm Claire. I'm a recovering compulsive overeater. I'm glad to be here tonight.
Hi, Claire.
I live in Snyder, but I'm visiting at the present time. And I go way back. There's not an OA group in Snyder, so I can't tell you a whole lot about my abstinence at this point. It's very shaky, but I just believe that if I keep going on, it'll get better day by day. Thank you.
Thank you. Glad you're here.
I'm Happy Witch Kit, not Wicked Witch anymore. One time I was, but not anymore. I've been in recovery since November the 2nd of 1986, and I've worked the program to the best of my ability day after day, and I am a happy person today, and I like who I am today. Thank you.
Thanks, Kit.
My name's Nancy, and I've been in the program on and off for a couple of years. I'm a sugar and carb addict, so I'm working on that right now, so hope to do better as time goes on.
Thank you. Glad you're here.
Patrick Mother. Recovering, believe it, again, a compulsive overeater, and I've been in the program since November 17th, 2010. And been a work in process with my absence, I have maintained 65-pound loss and have had leaps and bounds in my serenity and, you know, contentment. And that's about it for right now, for me.
Thanks, Patrick. Glad you're here.
Sharon Davis and I am Sunflower.
Hi,
Sharon.
And even though sunflowers follow the sun as they go across the sky, they always try to absorb as much of the sun's light as possible. And that's what I do. And I get to be standing in the sunlight of the Spirit in this program. I get to be present for life instead of being distracted by food and by obsession and by concerns about size, weight, shape, and all those things that I used to be obsessed with. And that doesn't mean that I never do those things, but a whole lot less than I used to. I've been absent from food obsession and from eating compulsively since March 29th of 2010 when I came back into the program. I had been in for 12 years and then I went away for 9 years and that was not a good thing, and then I came back and have stayed for the past 4.5. And so as I grow, it sometimes happens that there's windy days. And it sometimes happens that there's rain, and it sometimes happens that I'm having a really off day, and it might be the time when I pollinate, and that might be really stressful for me. But you know, as long as I have this program and I have people to reach out for and I have steps to reach out to and I have tools that I use to cope with life and a higher power that keeps shining that sunlight of the Spirit on me, I just keep growing one day at a time. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Sharon.
And Lisa the Lion. And I've been in program since January the 1st, abstinent. And I came back after a 25-year relapse, and I've lost 26 pounds. Mm.
Hi, Jim, compulsive overeater.
Hi, Jim.
Hi. Been around program in several 12-step programs for a number of years. And recently coming back from a dark time with the food, so reestablishing. Thanks.
Glad you're here, Jim. Thank you. Matt.
Okay, my name's Matt. I'm compulsive over here.
I'm Matt.
I've broken abstinence several times, but I've been back in the program for about 6 months, reached about a 55-pound loss throughout that, so I had some good stretches there. I'm not in costume. This is my daughter, Brittany.
Hi, Brittany.
I'm Ray, Matt's dad, and I like the program. Very good.
Thank you. Yes, y'all have been to both of our speaker meetings now. This is just our second one, so glad you're here. Welcome. So we have a couple of announcements that we want to talk a little bit about tomorrow. Tomorrow is our workshop on abstinence, and it will start at 9:30. And that is registration, and so try to be there and get registered so you can get in and listen to the speaker beginning at 10 o'clock. And we will have lunch for those who have ordered, and even for those who haven't, if we have enough, because we ordered a couple more. It's over at 4 o'clock. We will have a full day. Come prepared to work, to talk, to fellowship, and to be abstinent. And we'll really have a good day. It's going to be at the Church of the Nazarene on Bellway South. Everybody knows where that is, right? It's going to be a great day because we have the speaker tonight here from Utah, and she's also going to be speaking on the abstinence all day tomorrow. And she comes to us because she does service. And she is our Region 3 trustee. Now, what the Region 3 trustee does is kind of take care of all of the intergroups and the people in our region, which is 7 states. And y'all help me with this. I'm going to say Texas first because, after all, aren't we in Texas? And then there's Arizona and Colorado and New Mexico and Utah and Arizona. Oklahoma.
I said Arizona, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
Nevada.
So, you try to take care of 7 states, you're busy. So she's a busy gal. But what she does is she represents us at the World Service Conference. And that's in last of April, in Albuquerque. It's in Albuquerque every year. It's a whole week of work. For the fellowship, and she represents us there, and also she does the work for all of OA worldwide. So we're glad to have Vicki here tonight and tomorrow as well to speak to us, and I'll let her tell you her story, but I will tell you that we've known each other for a long time, but we really got acquainted in service, doing our service together. Got really acquainted, and she's been in Texas. She has 2 sons in Texas, which means that she does come to Texas, thank goodness. So I got to see her once before, or several times actually, in Texas. And she also makes 2 Region 3 assemblies a year. And they're not always in Texas, but many times they are. And the next one will be in Galveston. I want to mention something right quick that Barbara will probably talk about tomorrow. Or if you want to talk about it. You want to talk about it tonight?
No, you go ahead.
Okay. Well, Region 3 is sponsoring a cruise, okay? And it's going out of Galveston, and the cruise ship is Royal Caribbean. And that is March the 22nd through 29th. So we want everybody that likes to cruise, and if you don't like to cruise, you might learn to like it. So we hope that everybody checks it out. She'll have flyers tomorrow. And so I want to announce that so you can put that date on your calendar. We've had one other cruise sponsored by the region, and we had about 100 people there. And we would have workshops like this one and meetings on the cruise. And it was wonderful. And because you can get away from everything in your life practically when you're out there in the middle of the ocean, and you can just focus on recovery, and it's great. The other thing is that there is a new book out, and Barbara will have copies of those tomorrow, right?
Yes.
It's called the Overeaters Anonymous, 3rd edition. So that means we've had 2 other editions up to now. And what those other editions had was stories of people who were recovering when they were written. Well, so after two of those, the word went out that if the fellowship would send in their stories, they would have all new stories. So it has how many new stories? How many stories? It's like
37.
But they're all new, right? All new recovery stories.
Roseanne's
story.
And then the
founder, as her story is still in there. The rest of them are new stories. So if you've read the other books or if you haven't, these are people that some of us know and love that have written in this book. So Barbara will have those for sale tomorrow. So that's all the announcements I know about. Do you have anything?
If anybody is not coming tomorrow and wants one of those, I've got them in the car and we can do business.
Okay. All right.
How much are they?
$8.75. No, they're $13.75. I'm sorry.
I can't believe it. No, I'm sorry. Never mind. $8.75. I'll buy three.
Yeah, sure. I bought $1,000 worth of books, and they're $7.75.
I'm sorry. I was.
No, that's as close as I can get, but yeah. I think I said it at $14.75 or $13.75, right around there.
They're worth it. They are worth it.
You know, it would really be good just to say $14 and in your group have 25 cents off of each and save the treasurer. All right, so with that, I'm going to ask Vicki to come up here and tell her story. And let's welcome Vicki from Utah.
Well, I'm Vicki, and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Vicki.
I came into Overeaters Anonymous in April of 1996 in a little place you've probably never heard of called Wasilla, Alaska. And if you spell it backwards, it's all I saw, which is great for a compulsive overeater because that's how I ate. I was about 250 pounds. I've been maintaining 125-pound weight loss since about January of 1997. God did it, not me. that's God, not me. In backing up and starting with what it was like, you know, to join the group, I was born breech. I came into the world showing them my behind first, which I think is a commentary. Another result of that is that my mother was so wiped out after I was born, she didn't want to take care of me for about a month. So my grandmother took me, which I think is the root of a lot of my inadequacies. But, you know, who knows about a month-old baby? But, you know, I can blame her if I want to. And I was a skinny little kid. My dad says that I would go up to people and pull up my pants legs and go, "Vicki has pretty legs." When I was about nine, a perfect storm of things happened. One is that my mother and father divorced. My father was my buffer against my mother, who was abusive. And he joined the Navy and left. And I was spending more time with my grandparents, and my grandfather was also abusive. And so I lost my dad, and I was being abused any way a kid could be. And one day, and I was just hurting. One day in school, our teachers would line us up and weigh us all. And I was still a skinny little kid. But the little boy in front of me weighed 100 pounds. And my teacher said, "You weigh 100 pounds." Well, to my little 9-10-year-old brain, that sounded like approval. And it became my goal in life to weigh 100 pounds. And I started eating and eating and eating so I could get to be 100 pounds. Now, I was telling everybody in my life that I was doing this, and nobody said, "Vicki, that's not a good idea." They just let me eat and eat and eat. I remember the day I got on my grandmother's scale, and it was 100 pounds, and nothing changed. Except the next time I got on my grandmother's scale was 101 pounds. Somehow in the eating, I figured out that life didn't hurt quite so bad when I was eating, and I could get through things. I honestly believe that compulsive overeating was a gift to me so that I could get through my childhood all in one piece. And then I got to be an adult, and God gave me the 12 steps so that I don't need that survival technique anymore. And I have a lot of survival techniques. Anyway, I kept getting fatter and fatter. You know, I was the kid in school that was teased. Nobody wanted to sit next to Vicky. Nobody liked Vicky. My nickname was Icky Vicky. You know, I was a lot like my dad, and my mother couldn't stand my dad, and so she would use my name as a curse word around the house. And instead of calling me Vicky, she would call me stupid. So I grew up a little bit with a little bit of a skewed perception of myself and what the world was like. Just a little bit. But food helped. And I was smart, and that was one of my survival techniques, is I could outsmart you. I would read encyclopedias and dictionaries so that I could show you how smart I was. My dad taught me how to use a slide rule, and I would carry a slide rule around even when I didn't need it, because I knew I was the only person in the school who knew how to use one, including the teachers. But that was another survival technique. It was something I was trying to use so that I could feel a little bit better about myself. But none of it worked. And so I got to be, you know, through high school almost, and somehow between the 11th and 12th grade, something shifted in my brain, and I discovered not eating. And I not ate for about 3 months. So I went on vacation fat, came back skinny, and nothing changed. I thought that if I was a skinny person, people would treat me nice, but I was still teased, and people told me I was fat, even though I wasn't anymore. Nothing changed. Getting skinny didn't change anything. You know, well, I went to college, met this cute guy named Terry Wilcox, and we got married, and I had a baby, gained weight, didn't lose it all. Had another baby, gained weight, didn't lose it all. Had another baby, gained weight, didn't lose it all. Had another baby, gained weight and lose it. How many am I up to? I had 6. But with every kid, I would gain weight and didn't lose it all. And so by the time I came into Overeaters Anonymous, like I said, I was 250 pounds. My husband married a skinny lady, and now he was married to a fat one, and he didn't like that a whole lot. And he would say loving things like, if you really loved me, you would lose weight. Well, you know, I loved him, but I couldn't lose weight for him. Because basically every time I'd get ticked off at him, I'd eat at him. You know, show you. I couldn't. I would diet and lose weight and gain that back and more. And diet and lose weight and gain that back and more. And my times where I had lost the weight got shorter and shorter and shorter. And the amount of weight I gained after I got off the diet got more and more and more. And I couldn't stay on a diet more than a day or two when I came into OA. I would do lovely things like send everybody off to school, and I would start eating, and I would eat on the stairs so that if you sit like this, you can get more in your stomach. Did you know that? Sad but true. Learned all sorts of good things like that. I thought I was the worst mistake God ever made. I would look in the mirror and see this fat slob. I felt like I was stupid. I thought my husband regretted marrying me. I thought I was the worst mother in the world. And I would pick up these fat rolls and wish I could get a butcher knife and cut them off. I just, you know, I I hated me. I wanted to be dead. I was suicidal. I had a plan. We lived in Alaska, and I found the road, and I found the tree. I was looking for a road with a curve, with a tree, and the next icy day, I was going to drive straight off so it would look like I slid off the road because I didn't want my kids knowing their mother committed suicide. But I was waiting for an icy day, and going to nursing school because I thought getting a degree would help me feel better about myself. It didn't. but going to nursing school because I thought it would help. And I don't know if you know, but in nursing school, nursing students are supposed to go to meetings, 12-step meetings. And I was assigned to go to OA. Do you know how ticked off I was? I didn't belong there with all those people. But I was assigned to go to OA. And I called the lady and said, I'm a nursing student and would like to visit a meeting. And she said, great, come, we'd love to have you. And went to the meeting. It was the first time I heard the 12 steps. And listening to them, and backtracking, from the time I was a little kid and starting to get fat, I would literally get on my knees every night and ask God to make me skinny. And I believed with my perfect little girl faith that if I asked with enough faith, believing enough, that I would get up at the next morning skinny. And I just thought that because I wasn't getting up skinny, there was something wrong with me and God didn't love me. But literally, almost every night, almost missing very few, from the time I was about in third grade, about 9 or 10, until I went to that first meeting, I would pray to be skinny and pray to be happy. And I just got fatter and fatter and more miserable. Hearing the 12 steps for the first time, I literally got this voice in my head that said, this is what you've been praying for your whole life. And being the perfectionist, defiant person I am, I said, now this got me into recovery. I said, okay, God, literally, okay, God, this is not going to work. And to prove to you it won't work, I am going to do this thing perfectly. And when it doesn't work, it will be your fault. Guess what? Well, I got a sponsor that first meeting. I went up to somebody. Now, you have to understand that all four of us were obese. And at 250, I was probably the smallest person in the room. But I went up to one of these other ladies. I liked what she shared because she talked about her life and how horrible it was, but she didn't talk about being suicidal. So I thought she had what I wanted. But I asked her if she would sponsor me, and she told me a couple of years later that she did not want to sponsor me, and she thought that if she were really hard with me, hard-nosed with me, that I would run screaming. She didn't know that I promised God to do everything I was told perfectly. And so she said, call me at 7 in the morning. I called her, not at 6:59, not at 7:01. Perfectionist. She said, she gave me a plan of eating. She said, eat this. I ate it. I was miserable. I was like this, but I did what I said I would do. Dang it. And the weight started coming off. It came off fast. It was a very strict plan of eating. It came off fast. And I knew to start with that the 12 steps were about learning to trust God. But as soon as I started losing weight, it started becoming weight loss was a lot more important than the God thing. I was afraid. I had done so many diets, gained and lost. I didn't know when it would end. And I was afraid it would. So it started being that the most important thing to me was weight loss. And I thought the skinnier I could get, the more padding there was for when that time came and it stopped working. That was, anyway. So that's pretty much how things got started. I have pretty much been sticking to my plan of eating. Not pretty much. I have been sticking to my plan of eating since that first meeting. My plan of eating has shifted and changed over the years, But whatever it is, I've been staying with it. And how I did that, people have asked. And the first thing that really helped was my first sponsor, one thing she said was, she gave me the plan of eating. She said, take this home and pray about it. And I think you should do this, and I want you to see if God wants you to do it. So I went home and prayed about it, and dang it, I felt like God wanted me to do it. And so at that point, I knew that the plan of eating, whatever God's will for me was, that plan of eating was part of it. So knowing that God wanted me to do it helped, because I was a good church girl, and I did want to do God's will. And when it got really hard, it was sort of like, you know, you don't drink, you don't smoke, you don't do sex, you don't do drugs, and you don't go off this plan of eating. And that's basically what my plan of eating is for me, even now. It's a line in the sand. You know, it's that line I won't cross as far as my food goes. And once that decision is made that I won't go over that line, and it's the door is shut and bolted and locked, it's easier. It really, as long as I'm niggling with, well, maybe I might, you know, it's hard. But once I, one time early in my recovery, I was being tempted, as the disease can do. And I talked to the disease and I said, give it your best shot. I said, tempt me as much as you want. Make it as bad as you want to. I don't care what you do. I'm not going to eat. And you know what? It went away. You know, it went away. And I thought, oh, you know, it just wants me to fight with it. But once that door, once that line is drawn, once that door is locked and bolted, it got easier. I went to an AA meeting, and there's a guy from NA at the AA meeting, and I was just sitting and listening because there weren't that many OA meetings in Wasilla. At my second meeting, I was the person with the longest abstinence. But this NA guy at the AA meeting said, when the disease tells me use or go crazy, I can choose crazy. I never knew I could choose crazy. So the next time the disease said, Vicki, if you don't get in there and eat, you're going to go crazy, I said, okay, I choose crazy. And it could never use that again. My second sponsor said, when you are in trouble at 1 in the morning, call me at 1 in the morning. And I said, I can't do that. I can't wake you up. And she said, Vicki, you've got a disease that's going to kill you. Act like it. And I said, oh. And she said, you call me at 1 in the morning, and if I get ticked off, that's between me and my sponsor. That's not between me and you. It's between me and my sponsor. I said, if I don't answer my phone, you've got an OA list. You go down that list and you call everybody at 1 in the morning. And if they get ticked off, that's between them and their sponsor. And if nobody on that OA list is home, you get out the phone book and you start calling random people. Because you've got a disease that's going to kill you. Act like it. And so the first time, it was about 2 in the morning, and I should have been in bed, but I wasn't. I wanted to eat. And I looked at the phone, and I realized I was willing to make the phone call. I was willing to do it. And I looked at the phone again, and I said, is it really necessary? And I realized that the willingness to make the call was all it took. Once I realized I was willing to make that phone call at 2 in the morning, the disease didn't have me at 2 in the morning anymore. So these are all things that really helped me in the beginning. My sponsor had me make a list of 10 things I would do before I ate. And number 11 could be binge. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 was binge. And I didn't want to binge, so I made a list of 25 things. Perfectionist. But, you know, pray the Serenity Prayer 3 times. Try to call your sponsor. Call 3 OA people, and don't talk about you, talk about them. Memorize a paragraph in the big book. say the third step prayer, go for a 10-minute walk. You know, just this list of things. I got down to number 6 one time, and when I got to number 6, I realized that if I got to number 6, I didn't really want to eat. But the main thing was the steps. Working the program isn't about going to meetings and following a plan of eating. It's about working the steps. I'm in a 12-step program, and I'm in a 12-step program to work 12 steps. Step one, I'm powerless. There is nothing on the planet I have any power over. Nothing. My kitty cat will poop on the floor if she wants to. I can't control her. You know, there's nothing I can control. When I was, again, fairly early in program, I was feeling tempted. I thought, okay, I need to clamp down my food plan. I need to clamp down. And then, Vicki, you're powerless. What's the point in clamping down on the food plan if you're powerless? And I went, oh. So I prayed. And it kind of worked, you know. When I can turn it over, it doesn't make it go away fast, but it takes the edge off, and I know what my priorities are, and I know where my line in the sand is. But I'm powerless. I can't control this thing. I can't get my food in order. That's something that has to be 100% a God thing. I can get a plan of eating, and I can pray for it, and I can ask for God's help, but God's the one that gives me the power to stick to it. I brought this up because there's a few places I really, really like about step one, and a few other places. One of my favorite places. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And that was me. I ate because I wanted the effect produced by food. Somehow, I had imbued food with something that my higher power never meant it to have. Higher power meant it to be a nourishment for my body. He did not mean it to be a survival technique. But I wanted that effect. I wanted that feel better. And so I wanted the effect produced by food. When my oldest son was about 5, he came in one day and he said, "Mom, make me a Superman cape." So I got out my fabric and I made him a Superman cape, and I was very proud of it, and I put it on him. And he ran outside, and he was back in less than a minute, and he said, "Mom, this cape doesn't work. I still can't fly." He didn't want a Superman cape. He wanted to fly. I didn't really want the food. I wanted the effect. I wanted to feel better. I wanted to be okay. So, they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see other people taking with impunity. Part of my problem was that if there was a pie and a cake and ice cream or, you know, whatever, cookies, and I saw one person eating one and there, one person's getting brownies, one person's getting ice cream, one person's getting pie, I thought I should get what they all had. I wanted one of every one, not just one. No, one. There's four people getting one, and because all of them had one, I thought I should have one of all of it. And I thought that was... I saw the meeting with impunity and thought I could too. But restless, irritable, and discontented, I felt awful when I wasn't eating. Restless, irritable, and discontented. I felt bad. Drinks which they see other people taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. When I binged, I felt awful. I felt guilty. I felt bloated. So when I didn't eat, I felt awful. So I ate. But then when I ate, I felt awful. So I said, I'll never do that again. So I quit eating. But then when I didn't eat, I felt awful. So I would eat. But when I was eating, I felt awful, so I vowed to never do that again. So I wasn't eating. Then I felt awful because I wasn't eating. So there was this, that is my powerlessness. I am powerless to make myself be okay in my own skin by my own power. And I have tried it with food. I have tried it with shopping. I went through a stage after I got into OA where I thought it was getting a haircut was the solution, and I had much shorter hair than I have now. Shopping, you know. But I tried all kinds of things to be okay in my own skin, and none of it worked. I'm powerless to make myself okay. And this is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. At some point, God has to change me to the point that I'm willing to let go of this endless cycle long enough for program to kick in. And so I'm powerless. And then step two, there's a power greater than me that can restore me to sanity. Again, coming to program in Alaska, there's all these little back roads, one lane, two lane, little bit. And so you do a lot of your driving back there, and you learn that what you do is you tell somebody where you're going and what route you're taking, and you pack blankets and no cell service, but, you know, a little bit of food and whatever, and in case you get in trouble. And so my analogy is, it's minus 40, I've run off the road into a deep snowbank, I can't get my car out, and I didn't tell anybody where I was going, so nobody's going to be looking for me, and I'm going to die. It's too cold to stay with the car, it's too cold to walk, I'm going to die. But I see a light in a little cabin over there, only that one light, and there could be an axe murderer behind that door, and there could be somebody, a soul with some warm soup. I don't know. All I know is if I don't knock on that door, I'm going to die. And that's a power greater than me. You know, it doesn't matter. Whether or not I trust God to do good to me or not is irrelevant. There's a power greater than me who can restore me to sanity. Not who will, who can. Who maybe might. And I just have to be willing to... Step one is despair. There's no hope. Step two says, maybe there might be an answer. And I get to decide whether I get to go to that maybe there might be an answer or not. I mean, I can stay in despair if I want to, or I can also knock on that door. And step three is knocking on the door. Or being willing to knock on the door. Making the decision to put my will and life in God's hands. And then, step four, I don't really do it at step three. I don't put my will and life in God's hands at step three. I make a decision to do it. But when I'm angry, my will and life are not in God's hands. Because anger to me is, I didn't get what I wanted, self-will. When I'm in fear, my will and my life are not in God's hands because I'm afraid I won't get what I want, self-will. When I'm feeling guilty, my will and my life are not in God's hands because I didn't do what I wanted to do, self-will. When I'm angry or fearful or guilty, these are signs that my will and life, despite my decision, are not in God's hands. So much my fourth step is looking at all these places that despite my decision and despite my being a good church-going girl and thought I had taken care of this when I was 8 years old and baptized, despite all that, my will and life are not in God's hands. And I get to look at how, where, and what areas they're not in God's hands, and I get to see my character defects that are leading me to make the decision to be angry, fearful, guilty. But it's my character defects that are leading me to make those decisions.